Tonight, I'm going to talk about three very skillful mind states, that you will find out what they are. So, according to Buddhist mythology or legend, there have been Buddhas in other ages before, you know, before our age. In the Buddhist cosmology, there has been many different ages. There is no story about the creation of the earth or anything like that. It's something that has always existed. So there have been other Buddhas in other ages. Our Buddha in this age, Siddhartha Gautama was his name. He is the latest one in a long line of Buddhas. And according to this story, in a former life, many eons ago, he was a rich Brahmin called Sumedha. But eventually he started to feel disgusted with this wealth he had and all these Brahmanistic rituals he had to perform. So he decided to escape and leave home and become one of these wandering sadhus or ascetics that wander around India still today. And at this time, when he left home, the Buddha Dipankara, an earlier Buddha, the Buddha before, he was wandering around India. And somewhere Sumedha met Dipankara and his monks, his followers. And Sumedha was really impressed by Dipankara's power and radiance and clear mind and so on. So I guess he went to some talk, and when Dipankara was leaving, he saw that there was this muddy puddle on the road, and then he got this idea that he had long, long dreadlocks like the sadhus have in India, you know. And so he decided to spread out his dreadlocks over this muddy part of the road so that Buddha Dipankara and his monks could walk across there without getting their feet wet. And as he was lying there, he got this sort of vision or revelation that he would also become a Buddha. He sort of decided this, that he also wanted to become a Buddha. And just as Dipankara passed over his dreadlocks, he also uttered this prophecy that the ascetic Sumedha would actually become a Buddha in the future. And that is our Buddha, Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama Buddha. So that's the story about how he decided to become a Buddha. But to become a Buddha, you must first develop the 10 paramis, the so-called 10 perfections. And that they are 10 different, very wholesome states of mind. Generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, effort, patience, determination, truthfulness, kindness, and compassion. They are the 10 paramis that someone who aspires to be a Buddha must perfect, these 10 paramis. And you can read about these paramis in a collection of parables or myths called the Jataka tales. And they tell about the earlier lives of the Bodhisattva, both as an animal and as human beings. And a Bodhisattva is a person aspiring to eventually become a Buddha. But even if you're not thinking about becoming a Buddha right now, the 10 paramis can really be a great inspiration in life as a sort of guideline how a good person should be, what things there are to develop. So tonight I want to speak about three of these paramis that complement each other, and that's renunciation, determination, and effort. And all of these qualities are very useful and necessary in developing a spiritual life. First of all, like the ascetic Sumedha, we must decide what direction we want our lives to take. If we want to pursue a career or become famous, well, then we have to take steps and measures to do that. And if we want to achieve peace of mind and live a calm and withdrawn life, then we can try to achieve that. Or maybe we want to achieve a combination of career and spiritual life, and even that we can also be possible. So the first of these paramis that are useful things to know about. The first one is renunciation. And when you hear the word renunciation, I think most people think about something really boring, difficult, old-fashioned, like isolation and fasting and things like that. Or to refrain from sex and all other fun in life, to become a monk or a nun. But is it really that outdated and gloomy, this renunciation? Or is it actually a path to peace of mind and a better world? Once I saw this comic strip where the first picture shows this young man who's climbing up this mountain. And on the next picture you see this old guru-like figure sitting on top of the mountains in a lotus posture with long hair and beard and things. And this young guy comes up and bows to him and said, "Oh, great teacher, tell me how to be happy and wise like you." And the guru answers, "Simplicity, self-discipline, and renunciation." And in the last frame you see this young guy sort of looking around. Is there someone else I could talk to up here? It didn't seem so appealing to him with this self-discipline and simplicity and renunciation. And maybe that's how we feel too, but the Buddha called his teaching the middle way, which is a path that avoids all kinds of extremism. One should neither be devoted to constant worldly pleasures or enjoyments, or to excessive asceticism or, self-mortification. But renunciation is still an important part of Buddha's teachings, but it's not just about shaving your head or, renounce all the worldly pleasures. It is rather an attitude of the mind of scaling away the unnecessary, the superfluous, and things that only makes us confused and unhappy, really. If you take these 5 training rules that I was talking about, for example, the first 4, not to kill or steal or lie or commit sexual misconduct, they are actually universal moral rules. You can find them in every every spiritual tradition, and so they can't really be counted as renunciation. But the fifth one, to refrain from alcohol and drugs, which makes the mind foggy and unclear, that's a kind of renunciation. But of course it's a very beneficial one. But if you visit a Buddhist monastery in Asia especially, but also in the West, in the monasteries in England, for example, sometimes you might be required to abide by 8 rules. And those 3 extra rules are about practicing renunciation for the period you're staying there in the monastery. And the 6th rule says that you shouldn't eat solid food after 12 o'clock midday, because that's what Buddhist monks and nuns, they don't eat after 12 o'clock. So that's probably the most difficult one of the rules. But if you want to practice meditation really intensively, it's actually very good to have an unbroken time, because meals, that's always involving time off, expectations, and sort of losing a bit of the continuum of your meditation. So when you get used to not eating after 12, it's actually very beneficial for your practice. And the 7th rule is not to dance, sing, or listen to music, or go to the theater, or use jewelry, perfume, and cosmetics, which you rarely do in monasteries anyway. And the 8th rule says that you should not use high and luxurious beds. And it's a bit difficult to know what it's meant by that, but it simply is interpreted that you should accept the bed that you are assigned at the place. And to keep noble silence on retreat, as we do here, that can also be a sort of renunciation, but it can also be a relief, not having to socialize and talk to people all the time and sort of show off your best self. On longer retreat, you will also notice how energy-saving it is to be silent. It takes a lot of energy, all this talking. The mind gets really much calmer, and the inner dialogue calms down, and you don't need as much sleep either, because you save a lot of energy by being quiet. So even this silence, the renunciation of silence, is really something good. In Dhammapada, which is one of the scriptures, it's a small book with short sayings that supposedly the Buddha has said, there's a motive for renouncing the worldly things. If you, by giving up a small worldly happiness, instead can get a bigger and more lasting spiritual happiness, then it's wise to give up the small happiness for the benefit of the bigger one. So the Buddha never denied that there is much happiness to experience in ordinary worldly life too. There are a lot of nice sensations for all the senses, really. There are beautiful things to see, nice smells, nice tastes, and even intellectual pleasures for the mind, for the thought. And there's love and family life and children. And there are many nice things. But what the Buddha also saw is that all these forms of worldly happiness are very impermanent, and they can change very quickly when circumstances suddenly change, you know, and then they're replaced by unhappiness and suffering. And that happens all the time with all these different catastrophes and wars and even if it's these big kind of things where people lose their lives and their homes and things, just if a relative or someone dies or something happens in the family or an accident, whatever, all this worldly happiness is suddenly gone. So that's why the Buddha sought a lasting happiness. And what he found was that it's our relationship to people and things that create our unhappiness. It's the desire for and the clinging to things whose nature it is to change and disappear, which makes us unhappy. So the solution then that the Buddha thought of anyway is to develop a mind that doesn't hold on to the past, who can accept that things and circumstances in life change all the time, that friends and relatives become sick, old, and die. And so it's a mind that is not dependent on external circumstances for its happiness. In the book Food for the Heart by Ajahn Amaro, who is a monk in England, is the abbot of Amarvati Monastery. And in this book you can read about his teacher Ajahn Chah, who his teacher in Thailand, in the forest tradition. And he says, to many who met him, Ajahn Chah, he seemed to be the happiest man in the world, always cheerful. An opinion that may seem strange, because Ajahn Chah was someone who had never had sex. He became a monk when he was 6-7 years. He had never had any money. He never listened to music. And he was available for people's questions and problems 18 to 20 hours a day. He slept on a thin straw mat, had diabetes, and had had several kinds of malaria. And he just laughed heartily at the fact that Wat Pa Phong, his monastery, had a reputation of having the worst food in the world. So, in order to achieve this level of detachment, you must at least occasionally renounce worldly life. It's very difficult to achieve the concentration and continuity of mindfulness that is needed if you want to, if you're simultaneously involved in all the worldly business and stressing around and work and family and so on. It's very difficult to find that kind of peace and detachment. So it's not because the world is ugly or sinful or something wrong with it or useless. It's not because of that that we renounce it, go to retreats sometimes, or people become monks and nuns. But it's for the sake of developing equanimity, peace, and clarity in our relation to the world. And to this end, it is skillful to withdraw from worldly commitment for at least a time, once in a while, to lead a more simple and introverted life, like a retreat like this. So Buddha, he was always very careful and detailed in his teaching, and he made all these lists about things. So this is a list about renunciation. Because you practice renunciation in 3 steps. And the first step is external renunciation. And that is, for example, when a monk or a nun shave their head, Or when you refrain from jewelry and cosmetics and beautifying yourself during a retreat. It can also actually be in our society to refrain from polluting the environment, to leave the car at home and take the bike or bus to work, or donating money to charity. So these external things that you do, external renunciation, is a help and a really good practice to achieve true renunciation, which is step two. And true renunciation is an inner process, a mental process. It's to practice giving up greed, hate, and ignorance, the three unwholesome mind states that makes the world be such a difficult place to live in. And they also makes us constantly chase new experiences, getting this thing or getting rid of this thing, you know. Greed and aversion is always about getting things or getting rid of things. And ignorance, of course, is just not knowing what's the right thing to do, just being confused. So one can achieve this inner renunciation by practicing mindfulness and concentration, and to also practicing selfless generosity and morality, exactly what we do here on retreats and maybe also in our daily life. So finally, there is the third one, the ultimate renunciation, which is to renounce the illusion of the ego and thus all unnecessary mental suffering. The Buddha said, "I teach about suffering and the end of suffering." And someone asked, what is suffering then? And the Buddha answers, "Birth, old age, sickness and death are suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, anxiety and despair are suffering. To not get what you want and to be separated from what you have is suffering." So in Pali, in the Pali language that we use a lot in Buddhist texts and on, it is suffering is called dukkha. And this concept is not just suffering, it includes all sorts of unsatisfactory states, from the smallest mosquito bite to the biggest catastrophes that a human being can experience. So it's maybe a better translation to translate it as unsatisfactoriness, things that can't satisfy. And the end of suffering that the Buddha talks about is, it's a sort of figure of speech that points to Nibbana, the ultimate renunciation, the ultimate letting go. Why then is it so difficult for us to understand that impermanence and dissatisfaction are actually normal phenomena, that everyone will experience them sooner or later? Finally, we must anyway renounce everything. We can't take anything with us when we die. So when you understand this deeply, you can begin to see that renunciation doesn't mean to create anything or get rid of anything. It is rather just to relax, not having to manipulate, control, avoid, maneuver your life. We can open to life without fear and just take in the experience of the moment, whatever it may be. And renunciation isn't passivity either. It's rather the contrary. real ability to relate to life with wisdom and compassion arises in a mind that doesn't hold on to everything, because then it can handle both full activity and relaxation with ease. There is a freedom to act without selfish motives. Sometimes one hears that renunciation is an escape from the world's problems, a selfish withdrawal. But that's not the case at all, because renunciation requires great dedication and a lot of self-discipline. You can't escape problems, but you can try to solve them in the only rational way, by starting with yourself. So the Buddha says, it's not possible for someone who is stuck in the mud to pull someone else out who is in the same situation. But it is possible for someone who is not stuck to pull someone out who is. In other words, it's difficult to provide effective help to others if you have not helped yourself first. No one can solve problems for others if they haven't solved some of their own problems first. And that's why all these worldly problems that we have now must also, I don't think they can be solved just by a worldly way. They must have a spiritual dimension, a spiritual development, together with politics and so on. At this time when the earth is really suffering from pollution and climate change, and the rich part of the world overconsumes at the expense of the poor parts of the world, renunciation can very soon become necessary for all of us in order to survive. In our society, where greed has become so common that it's almost regarded as the normal way of being, it's important to become aware when there is greed in our minds, and which is coloring the way we look at the world. To notice this indoctrination we're constantly exposed to through advertising and the media, and not to fall into this trap of self-pity, which can provide a false motivation for why it is in order for us to consume more than we really need, when it's really generosity and renunciation that gives us more happiness and satisfaction in life. It's just they don't want to tell us that, because then the whole system would crackle, you know. All our society is built on consumption, and if we start to be satisfied and renounce things, that wouldn't, then all these companies and all the profit wouldn't happen anymore. So the next parami is determination. And determination might also be needed in everyday life. For example, you need to make decisions all the time. And you can decide on many different things that contribute to a better life for yourself and others. For example, to meditate every day, or to eat more healthy food, not to complain about a lot of things out of old habit, or to live a more simple life, as just a few examples. And we make small and big decisions every day, so you can also decide to pay more attention to the actual decision-making process. how do you actually make a decision? That's quite interesting. What factors do you weigh in? Are there mostly selfish factors? Or do you also consider the welfare of others? And to actually think about this, how you make decisions, can prevent harmful decisions and protect ourselves from and others from unnecessary suffering. The last one of these paramis that I'm going to talk about is effort. And so once we have made our decision about what we want to do, we probably have to make an effort to put this plan into practice. Just like this ascetic Sumedha I talked about in the beginning, when he decided to become a Buddha, it took many, many lifetimes to implement this plan. The Jataka tales talk about 550 different lives, but maybe there were even more, who knows. So right effort or energy is one of the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path, which is one of the core teachings of Buddhism. And it's also one of the enlightenment factors that we develop when we meditate, and also one of the 10 paramis. So the fact that effort appears on all three of these very important lists, that explains how essential the Buddha considered this factor to be. The amount of energy or effort we put into an action or a project is decisive for the result. So the Buddha also made a list about different kinds of effort. The first kind is launching or starting up energy, which is needed to start something. For example, coming to a retreat or coming to a sitting or observing the breath once you're already sitting there. All these things that you start, there is this little push of energy that you need to get started. And freeing energy is needed to observe difficult things like pain or sleepiness without becoming depressed or uninterested. So one can also call this kind of energy energetic optimism or curiosity. That's a sort of optimistic kind of energy. Sustainable energy is needed to deepen our meditation practice and gain deeper understandings of how things work. And the fourth one is completing energy, which is needed to reach the end of the path, Nibbana. Some teachers, such as Sayadaw Upandita I was talking about yesterday, they talk about heroic effort. Meditate like you have fire in your turban, used to say. And while others say that there's nothing to strive for, everything's already here, we're already enlightened, we just have to find out about it. And it's finding the balance between these two, the middle way that the Buddha talked about, between these two extremes. So if you're too excited and eager, you quickly become frustrated and tired. And if you're too relaxed and laid back, nothing happens. You just sit around and daydream. So another interesting aspect of effort, or we can even call it interest, is the will to investigate and explore which I've been talking to about before, how important it is to investigate. It's part of the RAIN method. So the effort gets balanced by itself when it's based in natural interest for in what we're doing. Sometimes we don't feel any interest. We feel, you know, depleted of energy and interest and motivation. And but if you look really carefully at even something very boring as breathing, you can see that it gives rise to a lot of interesting little sensations throughout the body, and it also changes in many subtle ways, in length, depth, and strength. Then, you know, breathing is also a mirror of the mind. When you have different mind states, like if you're angry, the breathing gets harder, and if you're really calm, it gets softer. And so there's a lot of interesting things to see if you actually use some energy. Another I think this is not so much time left. So when you meditate, you should try to observe the whole course of things, and you know, to see how things. Well, usually you see things when they're already there, but then you should observe what happens to them until they change or go away or whatever. And also notice what's happening in the mind at the same time, what feelings arise there. And this is important to deepen the meditation and make it more interesting, but it's also easy to forget. We're really accustomed of moving the attention all the time. They say that children, for example, have gotten less and less attention span. And I don't know, maybe it's this digital world where things are speeding up, that we've lost the ability to keep the attention on one thing for a long time. So then we never see the beginning and ending of things. We only see the middle part, because then we're already jumping over to something else. And that's not the way. When you meditate, you should try to see the whole process. And another important thing that I also talked about this morning, but I just mention it again, that's the continuity. And that is the sustained energy I was talking about. One must be persevering in the practice and not... I mean, they use this simile of when you boil water, you want to make tea, and you put a kettle on the fire, and then when it starts simmering a little bit, you take it off. Well, then it won't boil. And then you put it on again and makes it simmer a little bit, and then you take it off again, and you never get that tea. So it's the same thing with meditation. If you don't try to be as continuous as possible, then the energy that you build up, the momentum that you build up, slows down again. So it's the same with the concentration and mindfulness, that you have to be persistent. Otherwise it takes much longer time. So with the help of these three paramis, renunciation, determination, and effort, we can actually achieve whatever goal we set up for ourselves. It is possible for everyone to deepen their understanding of themselves and life through this direct observance of what is happening in the body and mind. It seems so simple, you know, but it's a really profound thing that you can learn so much from when you turn your mind inside and really see what life is all about. So that is why we meditate. That's the reason we meditate. And my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, he usually ends his talks with, "Have fun." But I'm actually going to end with a little poem again. And it's a poem that sort of illustrates this making effort and maybe failing and then making effort again. And maybe you've heard it before, but it's a good one. It's called "There is a Hole in My Sidewalk." Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters by Portia Nelson, the poet. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it still isn't my fault. It takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it's there. I still fall in. It's a habit. But my eyes are open. I know where I am. It's my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. So, let's sit for a moment.